It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the onslaught of holiday movies, we're wondering what classics make you feel nostalgic and what you think of new ones that are cozy and formulaic. Maybe you watch while wrapping gifts or decorating cookies. Call in about the holiday movie season. What movies you return to year after year? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is back, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater. Anna, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So,
always talk about holiday movies, so yeah.
Well, apparently we're going to get it out of the way right away. Does Die Hard count as a Christmas movie? Go!
All right. Well, in my opinion, no. No, it does not. And I'll tell you kind of my reasoning behind that. It was released originally in the summer, in July of 1988. And so because it was a summer release, you know, it was going after, you know, the kind of the summer blockbuster crowd. And so a little history can be illuminating when we get into those kinds of debates, you know. But, you know, in recent years, of course, it has been embraced, obviously, as a Christmas movie. And so I think I kind of got into a debate last week with some friends. And, you know, some people are just so committed now to the idea of Die Hard being a Christmas movie. And so, you know, I'm not gonna, I mean, I guess I kind of did burst their bubble, but but you know, people want it to be a Christmas movie. If that's your thing, then go ahead, I guess. But history can provide us with a little bit of answers there too.
So. But here's the thing. If a movie's plot takes place on or around Christmas time, is that a condition enough for calling a movie a holiday movie?
You know, I guess so. And actually, I wrote a little piece coming out in a couple weeks on Miracle on 34th Street. And that movie, too, back in 1947, was released in May of 1947. And that's kind of a fun fact about that film, that the producer at the time didn't even want any holiday-themed marketing for Miracle on 34th Street because he didn't want audiences to stay away from it because it was set during the holidays. So I guess, you know, that might be a criteria.
Or, you know, would the storyline of a particular movie work without the holiday element in it? Would it still be effective?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I think Die Hard would, right? I mean, it could take place during the 4th of July and it would still be, entertaining.
How do you define a holiday movie?
Well, I think the conditions are, you know, there for, you know, you got to have a little bit of the music, some kind of nod to Santa Claus. Again, if there's an old holiday standard, right, you know, as part of the soundtrack, I think mm-hmm. that's an important element, certainly. And, you know, some kind of, you know, coming together as part of the resolution, right? Whether it's a town or a family, or in the case of Die Hard, right? There is, you know, everyone kind of comes together at the end, right?
You don't have to keep going back to Die Hard.
right. Yeah. So some kind of resolution, or, you know, some overt theme of sentimentality or nostalgia, right? Mm-hmm. Those are all important ingredients for a good holiday film.
We're talking...
And bad holiday films.
And bad ones, right. Yeah. We're talking about the proliferation of good and bad holiday movies with Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater. Bring us your favorites. Bring us your duds. 800-642-1234. So, Anna, It's a Wonderful Life, Miracle on 34th Street, which you just brought up, and Christmas in Connecticut, examples of, you know, films more than 70 years old and considered classics. Why do these movies stand the test of time? Why do they continue to resonate?
So I think with these particular post-war films, I think the main reason ultimately is that the good writing. I mean, It's a Wonderful Life, which you just mentioned, you know, that still holds the number one spot for so many kind of top 10 lists or 20 top 25 lists of holiday films. It is a film that is incredibly well written, and that's actually, I was had told your producer earlier, that's a film I actually still teach in my classes. I teach it actually in a gender and film class because of Jimmy Stewart's is sort of timeless embodiment of George Bailey in that film. And it really is the writing. And these are films that were all made at a time when our country was really grappling with lots of questions and new anxieties about kind of veterans reintegrating back into society after World War II. And so these are films that offer maybe a dose of escapism, but they also are particularly resonant from that time. But then these are themes that are still, very much a part of our society today. And so these are films that are really just, again, extremely well-written films. I think that's why they hold up ultimately.
In the case of It's a Wonderful Life, though, I wonder how you approach teaching the spirituality aspect of it. Opening the movie opens with a prayer. There's an angel as a central character. And that, to me, that religious element doesn't seem as prominent in today's storylines, or maybe it is. What do you think?
So, it's interesting you mentioned that because, the last time I taught this film was in the wake of the pandemic. It was the fall of 2021, and I had a number of students, who were dealing with mental health challenges that semester. And of course, one of the main plot points is that George Bailey is contemplating suicide, right? I had a lot of students actually really connect to the film because, it has these deeper questions about, the meaning of life, that idea that one person can make a difference. And, because, I know suicide today, right, is just as is a huge mental health issue. That has actually made the film even more resonant to new generations of filmgoers and film fans. Because it's he was struggling. That character, George Bailey, was really found himself struggling, right, towards the film. And Clarence ends up being essentially someone for him to talk to, right, about his many challenges, and becomes certainly the person to say that, one person can make a difference. Look at all the things that you have done in your life. And again, that really spoke to my students the last time I taught that film. So I think, given all of our discourse lately about mental health, that it is a film that has found a new audience, or people can look seek that film out, and if they haven't had a chance to see it before, because it does have these timeless themes and themes that our society really is grappling with too. So.
Sure. Let's hear from another a classic here, Meet Me in St. Louis. This is Judy Garland singing to her character's little sister as the two worry about moving away from their friends.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year, all our troubles will be out of
So this song and the movie released during World War II, it's had a resurgence during the pandemic. Why did it become popular again?
So this, I this, what kind of got a second look in 2020, during the pandemic. There was an essay written by someone writing for USA Today about how the song, kind of took on new meaning regarding people's kind of anxieties and sadness during the pandemic. And this is a film again released during World War II, when there was so much uncertainty about when the war would end. And it has a rather kind of downbeat lyrics if you really listen to it. And so There was a historian who wrote an essay that basically said, this is a song now, kind of that he takes on new relevance given that we can't see our family, we can't see our friends. When is this pandemic going to end? All of these kind of articulating all these questions and finding again new relevance. Now, Mimi isn't necessarily a Christmas movie, writ large. There's a lot of other, it's kind of the year in a year in the life of a family, and whether or not they're going to have to leave their beloved St. Louis and move to New York City. And in the end, of course, their family doesn't have to move. But that particular scene is so poignant because this little girl, played by Margaret O'Brien, Judy Garland's character, is comforting her and telling her, it's going to be okay. But it is a kind of a very, it's a hard scene to watch because it she, you know, she's the little girl is so sad, and she ends up kind of going outside and destroying these little family of snow people she's built. And it's just it is very it is a song, I think, ultimately too, that just really spoke to our society. When we were kind of in the
In the
depths,
depths,
right?
in the dark. Yeah, and I want to bring in a caller here, Mark in Green Bay. Mark, a film you'd like to bring up?
The Bishop's Wife, Monty Woolley, Clark, Cary Grant, Loretta Young.
And why do you, what speaks to you about The Bishop's Wife? This is 1947.
Somewhere thereabouts. It's just something I grew up with, along with It's a Wonderful Life and old classics. And that's as Christmassy as you can get. Monty Woolley and his little one-foot-tall tree.
Anna, the bishop's wife.
Right. And that's actually, again, we're still in that same kind of post-war era. The Bishop's Wife does always make kind of those top 25 lists. It comes out the same year, actually, as The Miracle on 34th Street, and yeah, Cary Grant, as a sort of a timeless, actor that still today is remains very popular. That film was actually remade in the 1990s too, with Whitney Houston as the preacher's wife. And so that plot, he's, I think Cary Grant portrays an angel that tries to kind of help this couple sort of, kind of reinvigorate their marriage. And it is, again, a lot of the same sorts of themes, right? With like, angel and kind of the presence of angels, the kind of the way in which the family is kind of restored by the end of the film. These are kind of hallmarks of kind of what make a good Christmas film.
Oh, you said
That's certainly
Hallmark. We're going to pause there. UW-Whitewater film scholar Anna Thompson-Hodgick, our companion to holiday films. You can join in, call in with your seasonal favorites. Movies have won you over, others you've turned off, ones you've cherished from childhood. 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Once again, as in olden days.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we have film studies scholar Anna Thompson-Hodgick, who is our guide through the vast landscape that is the holiday movie season, the festive flicks to put on your holiday watch list. Join in with your favorite must-watch holiday movies, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in another Mark from Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. What films or films would you like to bring up?
Yeah, so I found it interesting. Disney and Marvel came out with a series called Hawkeye recently, a year or two ago, and they intentionally set it during the Christmas season to try to add some, an added layer of nostalgia and staying power for the series. The series really has nothing to do with Christmas, but I wondered if the guest had any thoughts on that as kind of a marketing strategy.
Mark, thank you. What about that, Anna, in the strategy of injecting some Christmas when, the plot line isn't about it?
Yeah, and I think that is actually a pretty astute observation. When you release a Christmas film, you can sometimes depend that it'll at least be re-aired, if it is halfway good, and that there is a kind of a way to appeal to, again, our nostalgia, our sentimentality, by just, infusing it with a little Christmas, right? And so that is, I think it can definitely be a marketing strategy of a way to, maybe get some of those, get it replayed on cable, and whether or not that's again a television show or a film, you can essentially ensure that it'll be around, right? And that happens both for films that are good films, but also films that are not all that good that still get replayed, right? Because they have a little bit of Christmas incorporated into their plot. So yeah, I think it can be a very astute marketing strategy for sure.
Let's look at the Hallmark effect here. The number of Hallmark holiday movies made each year has more than quadrupled since 2009. That's Forbes doing the accounting there. Why are studios churning out these movies?
So first of all, they're not that expensive to make. A lot of the time, they will star actors that are not maybe that well known, or maybe they were actors and actresses that had a more visibility in the 90s or a decade ago, and so they can they don't have to pay these huge salaries to film stars. But then there's just quite the, you might call it the Hallmark industrial complex, right? There are studios up in Canada where the majority of these films are shot. There's just a whole, they have a team of writers that do nothing but write these Hallmark films. And there are also other channels now too. It's not just Hallmark, but Lifetime, Oxygen, some of these cable networks that are already sort of gearing their content towards women. And they just have, again, a recent piece in the New Yorker really talked about how this is the closest thing we have now to the classical Hollywood studio system, where you have your stable of writers, you have your studios, you have your sets already made. And you have your essentially a team of actors that again appear in these same types of films again and again. And so, when you have all of those kinds of networks of production all set up,
All the components in place.
right, it can really bring the cost down to make those films. So yeah, they really kind of have it down how to churn these films out for sure.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick with us, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater, reflecting on holiday movies. So let's turn here to diversity, because holiday movies historically featured white, heterosexual, cisgender characters. And in recent years, there's been this effort to diversify. The 2020 film Happiest Season, Kristen Stewart's character bringing her girlfriend, played by Mackenzie Davis, home for the holidays. Stewart's character has been hiding her sexual orientation from the parents. And here's a moment from the film where the mom, played by Mary Steenburgen, who assigns the characters separate rooms.
Okay, well, we'll just show Abby to her room.
What, is she not gonna stay up here with me?
Harper, I would never ask two grown women to share the same bed. No, Abby will stay in Jane's old room.
How successfully have these attempts to, at diversity been?
So I think they are definitely, these more diverse stories are increasing in popularity, certainly. Another film that comes to mind, 2 years ago, there was the film Jingle Jangle that was released, that featured an all African American cast, and that was on Netflix, and I think quite popular, did really well, was critically reviewed well, and I think there's definitely an appetite for these more diverse stories. It's not, again, we tend to kind of hold up in our mind, right, these sort of films from the post-war era, But certainly a more diverse landscape is certainly a welcome development. And I feel too, you know, there's also, I noticed, I've just heard more a kind of awareness about particularly kind of the LGBT community and the in other sorts of media, you know, awareness of, you know, the young woman who going home doesn't kind of dreading seeing grandma, right? She doesn't necessarily want to come out to grandma, right? And that, I think that kind of sentiment is definitely sort of, you know, spilling over into films like The Happiest Season for sure. And it is very much reflective of our more, you know, just diverse landscape.
UW-Whitewater Film Studies and English faculty Anna Thompson-Hodgick, our guide to holiday-themed movies, calling about the latest entree of Hallmark and Lifetime holiday tropes. What you think? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How do you navigate the flood of holiday-themed movie offerings? Are you one and done, or do you watch them starting in October? Mike from Shell Lake weighed in. Mike is adding the first Lethal Weapon film as a Christmas movie with the criteria that it takes place in the holiday season. UW-Whitewater's Anna Thompson-Hodgick is helping us to think about the holiday season movies in new ways. Call in on how you take them in, 800-642-1234, and Anna stays with us. Let's bring in Jeff in Dubuque, Iowa. Jeff, hi. What film do you want to bring up?
Hi, good morning. I'd like to offer While You Were Sleeping with Sandra Bullock, Bill Pullman, Peter Gallagher. Just a great movie. That takes place over the holidays, themes of loneliness, family togetherness, love, romance, comedy, everything is rolled into one.
Why do you keep going back to it again and again? What speaks to you?
Oh, my gosh. By going back together again and again, I've watched that movie 65 times.
Goodness.
And it's because my wife has watched it 65 times, and she wants me to do that. Again, and what rings true is the seasonal loneliness, the fact that, you know, that the family togetherness, the wholesomeness of it. I mean, great cast, great themes that are universal and in a positive way.
Jeff, thanks so much for bringing that. Anna, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, that's one I kind of had forgotten that was a Christmas film or set near the holidays. And that is a lovely film. And, you know, that's a genre, kind of the romantic comedy that, you know, sometimes we kind of get overlooked in these holiday lists. But, you know, you think back to the kind of the Hallmark films, too. Of course, there's always a sort of a romantic, you know, subplot or, you know, something related to romance. And, you know, While You Were Sleeping is a film that, as I recall, it's fairly short, but it's a very, again, a very tightly written film. And yeah, I think the caller's point about, you know, the loneliness that can really affect so many people in real life, you know, that is an important theme that I think that film grapples with. And you know, it is a lovely film. And it really was one of those films, too, that I think really kind of helped make Sandra Bullock a star, too. And so thinking about kind of that, kind of her sort of star power in that respect. Another film that comes to mind is Sleepless in Seattle. You know, that's a film that has certain elements that take place over the holidays. It's, again, another kind of romantic comedy. And that, you know, again, the orientation towards kind of romantic, you know, kind of romantic comedy, again, that stretches all the way back to the 1930s, 1940s. Think of the film The Shop Around the Corner, for those folks that are, you know, into your older films, you know, has a really kind of cute little romantic subplot. Again, a stars Jimmy Stewart in a in a little in a cute film, but that it is also set again during the holidays. And so there is a long history that films that aren't just about families and children, but also about, you know, of course, coupling, decoupling, recoupling. And again, I think, yeah, While You Were Sleeping is a film that is a great entry into the holiday genre.
And Jeff gives us an entry here, and I'm glad he brought up the 90s, because there was a wave of classics like Christmas Story from 83 and the Santa Claus from 94. And then there was Elf in 2003. How have these types of movies evolved, and are they informed by the movies from the 40s?
I think so. You know, again, that comes down to, you know, what makes a film a timeless sort of Christmas classic, a movie that's actually worthy of being again re-aired again and again. It's not always about the good writing, because sometimes we have those films that get dated pretty quickly that will still pop up on our cable channels. But a movie like The Santa Claus, you know, that is a film very much of the 90s, but it is, again, it comes down to the good writing. You know, it is a film that it was made when Tim Allen was a TV star as well. He had his show Home Improvement that was quite popular. But then, you know, in a film that, you know, kind of spoke to, you know, he is a divorced parent in the film. The subplot revolves around this, his son who just doesn't get to spend as much time with his dad. And then of course, everything changes, right? When he accidentally kills Santa Claus and then has to become Santa Claus. And so, you know, it's kind of, again, it's a story about the coming together of the father and the son, laid over with all these kind of sentimental holiday themes, right? And the humor then that comes along with that. And that first Santa Claus, I think, is certainly the best. I think there were three ultimately made, and then they kind of regurgitate the plot, you know, in the subsequent sequels. But that first Santa Claus, I think, is, you know, it was popular because it did speak to kind of the contemporary concerns of the 1990s family in many respects. But it's kind of held up as a classic, or modern classic, because it still, you know, it has these same kinds of, you know, it still speaks to kind of some of the same challenges that the modern American family faces, right? You know, not having enough time with your kid, you know, taking on that subject of divorce, right?
Mm-hmm. I want to zoom in on Elf here, which also plays on heavy rotation in our household. But, you know, starring Will Ferrell portraying a human who is raised by Santa's elves at the North Pole and comes to New York in search of his birth father and finds work as a department store elf.
Okay, people, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., Santa's coming to town.
Santa! Oh, my God!
Santa here? I know him. I know him.
It's hard to, oh my gosh, it's hard not to smile that Will Ferrell's performance in this movie is just so over the top. What do you love, Anna?
Yeah, I mean, this film, I think, was really made by Will Ferrell's performance. But then again, you know, he's got a movie out right now that has not done nearly as well as Elf, that film Spirited, which is kind of a remake of A Christmas Carol. But the thing about Elf, again, it can comes down to the good writing, ultimately, right? At the end of the, you know, and casting, you know, the film co-starred Bob Newhart, you know, as his kind of adopted father, which is like, you know, a brilliant bit of casting. And I, you know, I had mentioned to the producer that I think, you know, we can look at this film with a little more sentimentality this year because James Caan, who plays his father in the film, had passed away this year, right? And so, but Caan, when he was cast in this role, you know, he kind of brought all the baggage of Sonny Corleone, right? And kind of the kind of that, you know, kind of this kind of rascally figure. And again, so that was a brilliant bit of casting in this kind of this character that had a lot of baggage, right? Didn't realize he was a father to this elf, you know, man elf, I guess you might say, right?
the casting and the writing really coming together is what I hear.
Right. That, and that's, yeah. And that, you know, that's, I think one of the reasons too, Elf has had such a strong afterlife. Mm. And that's, again, it's a film that's not only been popular on its own, but has spawned, adaptations on stage too. People wanting to see this adapted for the stage, which I think is also very interesting. So,
Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies in English at UW-Whitewater, as we talk about holiday movies, what you think of them, adding yours along the way at 800-642-1234. Ooh, I want to pick your brain about Love Actually, 2003. I understand you don't like the film. What is your take on it? Because it's complicated. There are a lot of issues here.
Right. So this film, it gives another one of these examples of a film that I guess my own opinion is that it doesn't necessarily deserve all of the attention that it subsequently received. ABC had a 20th anniversary special.
It's been 20 years. Can you believe
right,
it?
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think just, it's just, again, spawned so many parodies. You know, there's a commercial going on right now. You know, it's always the scene with the cue cards, right? But I think, again, there are elements of the plot that just haven't worn well, right? In terms of kind of the romantic entanglements and that sort of thing. And so that's part of the issue I have with the film is it's just... To me, it comes off as cloying in certain ways. And so, that's my opinion. I mean, I know.
All of these, so many jokes about women's weight and women just not having agency in the film. I mean, one critic looking back at it called it cheesy sexism. And that seemed to me, that seemed pretty fair. Can you just explain a little bit about these problems that you see in Love Actually?
Yeah. So again, that as you mentioned, kind of the jokes about women's weight, the philandering husband, Emma Thompson's character who just seems to not have any agency in this relationship and her husband's kind of affair that it takes place. And then tying all that up in a nice neat bow at the end, and it's just. There's just lots of, and we talk so much about resolution, right, in our holiday films that we like. And to me, there's just a lot of unanswered questions by the end of Love Actually. That's one of my problems with the film. But just again, kind of the gender politics of the film are problematic too. And, it does demonstrate, I think, too, in some ways, how far we have come, right, in terms of our. In terms of gender discourse, but since 2003, 2002. It's just a film that, again, endlessly parodied to, because I think people do realize that it's a very superficial film in a lot of respects. That, I guess that's another reason I'm not a huge fan of it. So, and the thing is, the film does have some really quality actors in it. There's Alan Rickman,
amazing cast,
Hugh Grant, Keira Knightley. But again, I just feel that those actors are not utilized to their best potential. I much prefer Alan Rickman's performance as Hans Gruber, frankly, to bring it back to Die Hard, as compared to his performance in Love Actually. So,
UW-Whitewater's Anna Thompson-Hodgick, our guide to the holiday movie classics and the modern feel-good one. Still time to talk. Call in with your questions for a film scholar about holiday movies, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and there is no shortage of holiday-centered movies to watch this season, from the rom-coms, the winter romances, the animated classics from childhood. Lisa in Whitefish Bay sent along an email, and their favorite is The Bishop's Wife as well, from 1947. Lisa says, the message of taking care of each other sums up the true meaning of Christmas. Still time to talk about the beloved genre of holiday films. What comes up for you? 800-642-1234. We have Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater. Anna, Charles Dickens' classic A Christmas Carol has been, you know, the basis for more than 100 films. We've talked about Will Ferrell a little bit with Spirited, but why does the Dickens story continue to get new interpretations?
Well, again, I think it just comes down to kind of that timeless quality of this particular story. You know, again, particularly, you know, Ebenezer Scrooge is someone that, you know, clearly goes through a transformation, right? We all kind of like these kind of transformational stories. But he's given this, you know, amazing opportunity, right, to look backward, to see his future, and to, you know, kind of take stock of his life in the present, right? That don't we all wish we had the opportunity, right, to kind of, you know, to do what he have the opportunity that he has. And I think I had read somewhere that Dickens originally was asked to write a much more scary story, right, for Halloween, and then he comes up with this story instead. And so there are these kind of elements to A Christmas Carol that do have obviously a supernatural elements, and yet, you know, by the end, you know, there's all this kind of happiness and joy, and it it kind of, again, it reaffirms the family, the power of the family. It reaffirms, you know, the idea that, you know, someone can undergo a transformation in their character, right? And I think, again, that is tremendously appealing.
And I wonder, the lending itself to stage adaptations and community theater. And I wonder if that, too, helps the story have such staying power.
Correct. Yeah. I think, when we think about Elf and its afterlife, right, that, you know, the ability of this story to be adapted for the stage, you know, to see it in, you know, if you want to watch the Muppet version, you can, right? you can also go out with a family, nice one, you know, kind of snowy evening, and see it performed on stage. I'm originally from Minnesota, and I know that one of our theaters in the Twin Cities, the Guthrie.
Yeah, I'll name it.
They always do an amazing job.
Yes, they do.
Right, with all kinds of bells and whistles, and you know, kind of that supernatural element is really played up on stage, and so we have so many options to consume A Christmas Carol that I think too that's one of the reasons it remains so popular.
Let's go to Faye in Minocqua. Faye, hi.
Hi. I can't believe that no one has suggested Christmas Story. My daughter introduced us to that movie 30 years ago, and I think we've watched it every Christmas since then.
How can we drop Christmas Story? And it's become, it sounds like, a real tradition to watch it in your family.
Yes, it has.
What resonates? What do you like about it?
Well, the characters are just, you know, unforgettable, especially Ralphie. And, you know,
they make you laugh.
Your eye out. How can you forget that line?
Faye, thank you. Anna, you know, what's staying power there with A Christmas Story?
Yeah, you know, this is a movie, too, that's about certainly a favorite in our household. And, you know, the story behind this film is interesting because it was a film that when it was released in 1983, it was kind of a sleeper hit. It didn't really catch with audiences until much later when it got aired constantly, re-aired on cable television. And so, you know, and then it kind of slowly but surely found its audience. And it's a film that doesn't have, you know, huge big name stars. It certainly has talented actors and actresses in it. But the re-airing is kind of what made it to become, you know, such a popular film. And I do want to mention that there is a sequel out on available through Apple TV, and it's called A Christmas Story Christmas. It's kind of gotten mixed reviews, but there's certainly certainly the more sentimental of film critics have found something to like in it. And it does star Peter Billingsley, you know, the actor who played Ralphie originally. And so it's set in the 1970s. And as he sort of with the, when it kind of opens with the death of the old man, the father. And then he the premise is that Ralph, now Ralph, and 51 in the film, goes back home to spend Christmas with his mother and tries to recreate the same kind of Christmas he had as a young boy. And so, you know, again, I agree with the caller. It is a kind of a one of these classic films. But it took a while. It kind of took a while for the film to become considered a classic, just because it didn't have that same success at the box office when it was originally released. So,
and yeah. And we might have to end here on horror. Chris from Milwaukee called in, and Chris recommends the holiday-themed horror movies Rare Exports from 2010 and Krampus 2015. Chris says it's great to watch a holiday-themed horror film this time of year. How about the horror genre, Anna?
Yeah, so that's a genre that I've never kind of gotten into, Christmas horror, but it actually has long roots too. It goes back to the film Black Christmas was kind of the first sort of entry point for horror film that was made in the 1970s. And yeah, there's an appetite for it, certainly. There's still, you know, folks that want to kind of spook themselves. And you know, we can actually, I mean, we talked earlier about a Christmas Carol. There are elements, right, of a little bit of supernatural, right, with the ghosts of the Christmas past and present and future. And so you know, the very end of a Christmas Carol, when he's, you know, the future, right, is essentially it's death, right, showing Scrooge what his future may be if he doesn't shape up. And so we can find those elements even all the way back to Dickens. So
very quickly, as we wrap up here, this formula seems to be working. Do you anticipate the holiday movies to become around Valentine's Day or Thanksgiving? Do you think that this theme style will continue?
Oh, definitely. Right. I mean, again, it's, you know, the Hallmark Channel has it figured out, right? They have their system in place, right, to crank out these films. And clearly they're doing it because there is always going to be an audience for Christmas films. I'm not necessarily so sure we see that as much with Valentine's Day. Certainly Halloween, we have a lot of pop culture that continues to be popular with audiences. So,
well,
but yeah.
Anna, this has been so much fun. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It's always a pleasure. So, yep.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.